Okay, good morning, and I'm talking about the assessment of cyanotoxins and their public health significance in West Michigan lakes, and I have no financial interest to disclose. Starting out, cyanobacteria, and I learned about cyanobacteria as blue-green algae, but they're called cyanobacteria now, and they're very old organisms, 3.5 billion years old. They're thought to be the first photosynthetic organism on the planet. They're extremely adaptable to extreme environments. They can withstand desiccation, permafrost, high UV, low light conditions, low nutrients, and a wide range of temperature environments. They come in unicellular, colonial, and filamentous forms. 30% can fix nitrogen, so if nitrogen is limiting, they can fix atmospheric nitrogen. And we call them primitive, but they're extremely complex on a biochemical standpoint. So they're not like eukaryotic organisms with organelles. They have to do everything unicellularly. So they're extremely complex in what they do biochemically. And the interest about them is they produce hepatotoxins and neurotoxins. So that's why we're talking about this today. A couple other factors interesting about them. Most plants only consume as much phosphorus as they need to grow. These organisms can accumulate more than what they need, so they can actually store phosphorus and then float to the surface. The last part is they can develop gas vacuoles, so they use that as a competitive advantage. They can live at the bottom of the lake, pull in nutrients, and then develop gas vacuoles, float to the top, and shade out other forms of algae or plankton. So extremely interesting organisms and very complicated. We think we're seeing more cyanobacteria blooms because of cultural eutrophication, non-point source runoff and things like that. Certain types of exotic species will consume regular algae and spit the cyanobacteria out. Zebra mussels in the Great Lakes do that very well. And also increased global warming can also cause more cyanobacteria blooms because they're warm water loving organisms. They can produce the cyanotoxins like I mentioned, and they're a threat to human health because we can be exposed through drinking water. The toxins are accumulated in fish that has not a real high bioaccumulation, but there's actually been issues where people have eaten pond raised fish that had cyanobacteria blooms and accumulated the toxins that way. And they can also be accumulated through exposure to aerosols during recreational activity. So if you're jet skiing or water skiing, you can accumulate those materials too. So that's some of the health hazards associated with these organisms. And there's three toxins that we're mostly concerned about. Microcystin is the first one. It's a polypeptide, and I think it looks like the Klingon warship from this first Star Trek issue. It's got this ATA group sticking out, which is hydrophobic, so it's fat-soluble, and it's got a water-soluble chain on it. There's 90 different forms of it, 90 different congeners, and when you look at toxicity, it's 25 to 60 micrograms per kilogram, and in perspective, cyanide is 4 milligrams per kilogram, so it's quite toxic, and it's not only a hepatotoxin, but it's also a tumor promoter, so having this in the water system and exposure is certainly something to be concerned about. The other one, common one, is anatoxin. That's an alkaloid. It's produced by anabina, which is a chain-forming cyanobacteria. Less toxic, but it's a neurotoxin, so it's very rapidly toxic if you're exposed to it. And this is a lot of times dogs will die after getting into the water, and this is typically an anatoxin exposure because they lick the cyanobacteria off their fur. And then sort of serendipitously, we found this organism growing, and it's a subtropical species, Solanospermum opsin, and we found this one growing in Solanospermum opsis is the organism. Solanospermum opsin is a toxin. We found this growing in northern Great Lakes, so that could be, again, because of warming temperatures. It doesn't, the toxicity isn't as great, but it's both a hepatotoxin and a neurotoxin. And what's concerning about this is one of the few cyanobacteria that excretes the toxin in the water. So most of the other ones, the toxin is in the algae itself or the cyanobacteria. This one will actually excrete it in the water. And You can differentiate it from others. It's got this little candle-like tip on the top of it. That's how you can tell it from other cyanobacteria. So these are the toxins that we're mostly interested in. And in our area of West Michigan, two counties, Muskegon County, Ottawa County, we're looking at seven drowned rivermouth lakes. These are lakes that have a river flowing into them, and then the Great Lakes is at the other end of it, so it's kind of backing up the water like a dam or a reservoir. And because we're having rivers flowing in, there's a lot of nutrients in these lakes, so they have cyanobacteria blooms, and they're very important recreationally as fisheries and sailing and water sports. In terms of methods, you can look at the water, and if you see the cyanobacteria, we'll talk about each one of these in more detail, but you can do just a visual test for it. You can look at total chlorophyll. You can do plankton counts, identify what species are there. And then as far as analytical chemistry, there's an ELISA method, there's an immunoassay method that you can run. There's a HPLC-MS, chromatography mass spectrometry method. And then there's also an activity-based method called protein phosphatase inhibition. And we'll go into all these in the next slides. You can tell cyanobacteria blooms pretty easy from other types of algal blooms. And I've got two pictures up here. The top one is cyanobacteria, and that forms a floating scum on the water. The other one that we have in the Great Lakes is Cladophora. That's the bottom slide, filamentous masses of algae. And I don't want to say that Cladophora is not hazardous. Cladophora has avian botulism associated with it, so it's definitely not good to have. But you can pretty much tell if you have a cyanobacteria bloom by looking at for that floating like paint scum on top of the water. In terms of chromatography, there's both LC-MS there's also LC-UV, so you can use an ultraviolet detector or a mass spectrometer. If you're using the mass spectrometer, you can get 100-fold better detection limits, so you can be real sensitive, sub-microgram per liter concentrations. And the chromatography is kind of tricky because the different forms of microcystin, sometimes you can have leucine and arginine. If you pair two arginines on it, you've got two bases and the chromatography is different. So there's a little bit of a separation issue there. But the nice thing about it is you can get very accurate results. The downside is you have to have standards. There's only five commercially available standards for these 90 different forms. Right now, the CDC is running 13. They've got access to a lot more than what university and commercial labs do. But if you have the standards and you've got those in your sample, this is certainly a good way to measure it. ELISA is a generalized immunoassay, and everybody reports the results in terms of LR, which is the most toxic form of microcystin, but it has cross-reactivity, so other forms of microcystin will react in the test. And it's got antibodies in a plate, and you add your sample, the microcystin will stick to the antibody, and then you've got areas in the plate, depending on concentration, that are left open. You add an antigen, and then you release the antigen. And actually, the samples that have the highest concentrations have the least color because there's the least number of open wells in the plate for the antigen. So if you're looking at concentrations, usually you're struggling with detection limits, with low color producing assays. But this one, if you have a high concentration, you get a very low color. So it kind of works in reverse. And that creates some problems with the testing. And like I mentioned, cross-reactivity. It's got a very limited range in terms of the testing range because of that reverse color issue. And the last thing is it's cheap, $15 versus $100-some dollars for the LC-MS. PPIA method is a colorimetric method. It's really inexpensive, $5 a test, and it doesn't differentiate between all the forms of microcystin. So if you want to know a total assay, a total amount, it's really good, but in terms of whether you've got the most toxic form or not, you don't know. So each one of those test methods has some value and some pluses and minuses. And here's some examples of cross-reactivity. If you look at the PPIA, that's one that measures general activity, and we can look at our four common toxins, and they all react about the same in terms of protein phosphatase inhibition. In terms of ELISA, Microcystin, LR, the most toxic form, is set at 100% activity, but RR is 54% active, and you can look at the difference. There's an order of magnitude more toxicity associated with LR than RR. And some of the other common ones, like LA, 61% activity, and it's comparable. So if you're just looking for LR, the ELISA test reports the result in terms of LR, but it's not necessarily what you're getting. The WHO has recreational water standards, and like I said, this could be either incidental ingestion or contact through aerosols. They have some dermal contact issues, too. It can be absorbed through the skin a little bit. But for microcystin LR, that's the only one the WHO has a standard for. They have a moderate advisory of 20 and then a high advisory of 100. And if you're over 100, you're supposed to close the beach down. That's, we do a lot of beach monitoring. So sometimes we're looking for, when we see the floating algal scum, we'll go and do the test. They also have a standard for chlorophyll and a standard for a number of cyanobacteria per milliliter, and we thought we'd run all the different assays and we'd run those different endpoints in terms of chlorophyll and number of cells and see which tests gave us the best results. And we analyzed about 30 samples from each one of our seven lakes, and in terms of microcystin LR by mass spectrometry, we only had two events in one of the lakes and one event in another lake that was greater than 20, that was above the standard. Most of them were somewhere between 1 and 20, and then some of the lakes didn't have anything above 0.1. So there was a big discrepancy in the levels of toxins amongst all these different lakes. And we also looked, like I said, chlorophyll and the number of cyanobacteria per milliliter. And all of the lakes flunked the cyanobacteria per milliliter, and some of the lakes flunked chlorophyll consistently. So those really weren't good indicators. You've actually got to measure the toxin. You can't do the general tests for that. And in terms of looking at statistical significance or comparability between the different tests, in Muskegon Lake, the LCMS gave a pretty comparable number to ELISA. But in Bear Lake, the numbers were statistically different. PPIA was always high. So in certain lakes, you get good correlation across three methods. In other lakes, you don't get that. So it's pretty much a lake-specific phenomena, and it relates totally to what species of cyanobacteria are present. And here's just some plots of the different methods. This is ELISA versus LCMS. Remember, ELISA has cross-reactivity. You can see Muskegon Lake, and some of the lakes are right along this line. There's a one-to-one relationship between the two tests. Other lakes, there's a high bias for the ELISA method. So if you're trying to compare whether you meet the WHO standard for microcystin LR, if you run ELISA, you're going to overestimate the hazard by using these other tests. This is ELISA versus the total. We looked at four different toxins, and you get a much better line that way, but again, you're not looking at the most toxic form. And this is PPIA versus ELISA, and Bear Lake and Lake Macatawa are atypical. They have much higher levels of total congeners compared to the four ones that we typically measure. So again, there's no one size fits all for looking at microcystins in any of these lakes. And just to show how variable it is, in 2007 we did some screening for the first time, and we had two events where the beaches were closed. What's interesting to look at, though, is that this one cleared up totally in one day. This one cleared up in about a week, but sometimes the cyanobacteria bloom can be gone. It's typically when you have a wind event that spreads things out a lot. In terms of Solenospermopsis, we wanted to do the genetics on that one, and we actually looked for the gene for Solenospermopsis, which is was present in a number of the lakes, and we actually were able to count it. We just wanted to make sure, because it was the first time we ever saw this organism. But all of the organisms, Solenospermopsis organisms, do not have the ability to produce toxins, so That was really a good thing. It was bad because I can't do any more research in that area, but it's good that we don't have a toxic producing form. So to summarize the results, the ELISA test gave us between 1.5 and 2 times higher results if other congeners were present. 25% of the samples exceeded the 50 microgram chlorophyll, and 75% exceeded the cyanobacteria cell count numbers. So those were pretty unreliable, since we only had 2 events that were above the limit, or 3 events. And the lakes with the highest level of microcystin had Microcystis aeruginosa, so that's a certain form of cyanobacteria that does produce toxins. We had microcystis in some of the lakes, but it was a non-toxic producing organism. In terms of some of the other conclusions, the LCMS gave really good results for LR in 3 of the lakes. We got really good precision and accuracy with it. ELISA was a good screening tool, but it was only accurate if we had LR as the major organ, the major congener, and we had RR as a very significant player in some of the lakes. I mentioned about the chlorophyll A not being reliable, and it's interesting that the cyanobacteria populations were very different in the lakes, even if we had relatively similar levels of nitrogen and phosphorus. So there's other factors that contribute to cyanobacteria blooms, and we determined that local conditions had a stronger influence than general regional conditions, and there was subtle differences in nitrogen to phosphorus ratio, subtle differences in terms of residence time, and turbidity seemed to be a big number, a big factor also. So we've got 3 papers published on the different environmental conditions that affect the lakes. And the results are not similar between years, so when you find a problem and then you apply for a grant, there's no saying that you will get high levels in your grant year. And lastly, that the Slindosporomopsis was not a toxin producer, which was good. So I wanted to acknowledge the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the Annis Water Resources Institute for funding this, and then NOAA Glural has a wonderful website where we can report all this data, and they keep track of cyanobacteria blooms across the Great Lakes. So that's it. Thank you.